It's Lions, Towers, and Shields from the Incomparable Network. I'm Shelley Brisbane, your host. This is episode 37, wherein we discuss Night Nurse. Night Nurse is a comic book series published by Marvel Comics early in the 1970s. Linda Carter, one of the series' three central characters, was previously the lead of another Marvel series, Linda Carter, Student Nurse, published in 1961. Carter later adopted the name Night Nurse for herself, and in this incarnation, first appeared in Daredevil 58, May 2004, as a medical professional specializing in helping superheroes. That's just for my friends at The Incomparable to prove that I know how to read Wikipedia. Actually, no, we're going to do a different Night Nurse, but to help me do that, I need a panelist, and he is Nathan Alderman. Welcome back.
Says you, sister. Says you in a big way.
We are back in 1931 for Night Nurse. We're not talking about any Marvel superheroes, although, you know, I had to throw that out for the Incomparable fans.
Sadly.
I know, right? Maybe we should have gotten Linda Carter involved in some way.
You know, there have been
Wonder Woman Linda Carter, but
there have been two live action adaptations of that Night Nurse. There was they kind of split her into two characters, one for television and one for the movies. Rachel McAdams' character in Doctor Strange is like half of that character, and Rosario Dawson in the Netflix Marvel series is the other. But we're talking about Barbara Stanwyck this time.
We are indeed. The Night Nurse of the title is Barbara Stanwyck. We are back to do another Barbara film. And this one's directed by William Wild Bill Wellman, one of the preeminent pre-code directors. He did a lot of other things as well, including movies with a lot of aerial stunts, of which this has none. Other people in this movie are Ben Lyon, who you probably don't know, but we'll talk about shortly. Some guy named Clark Gable, who's a really mean man. And the ever delightful Joan Blondell. So we're off to a good start.
Cracking gum and cracking wise the whole way.
I had forgotten that Joan Blondell was also an attraction of this movie, and I'm really ashamed to say that because she and Stanwyck are delightful together, and we'll get to that. But so we are firmly planted in the pre-code world. But the thing I will say about this pre-code, because usually pre-codes are about illicit romance and about people who are sleeping together who shouldn't, or people who are trying to accomplish things by sleeping with people they shouldn't. This is not quite that. There's illicit stuff, and there's a lot of scantily clad women in it, but it is not...
So many women
so
in their underwear.
So many women in their underwear. But it is not a story about illicit love. It's much more about the decadence of the Prohibition era.
This movie is wild. Wild. Bill Wellman is not as wild as this movie is. This movie is the wildest pre-code I've ever seen. And considering some of the things you've had me watch for this program, that is saying something.
You are correct.
This movie has everything. Clark Gable as Darth Vader, fascist chauffeur. Barbara Stanwyck punching a lady in the face. Someone screaming, "I'm a dipsomaniac and I'm proud of it." Attempted child murder. Contract murder as a romantic token of love. This movie is incredible. And if you haven't seen it, you are in for a treat.
Just Another Day at the Beach. Absolutely, you are. It's one of my favorites. And it's one of the pre-codes that the thing about it is that it has a lot of early 30s filmmaking style to it, which sometimes turns people off. But it's absolutely worth it. And if you do sit down to watch it, you will be arrested. Well, maybe not literally, but you will be arrested by the first scene, which is from the point of view of the inside of an ambulance as it goes down a street, which is not the sort of shot you see in movies of this era at all. And so it's startling and it really gets your attention.
Between this and The Public Enemy, I'm really becoming a big fan of William Wellman because, especially given the limited technology at the time, he pushes the envelope in really interesting and visually stylistic ways. Cameras at this time had to weigh a ton, and yet he's doing these really wonderful, ambitious tracking shots through the hospital to show you a sense of the life and the motion of the place. He does all kinds of clever things with sound, with clever compositions and framing. There's a set piece involving a surgery, and there's a sequence sequence where the sound tells you that something has gone wrong with the surgery, and then he cuts back to show the geometric formation of all the students looking on, simultaneously leaning forward in their seats. This movie is visual dynamite.
I think the visual stuff, especially the tracking shots, has to have been influenced by the fact that he did so many films about airplanes. Wings, the first Oscar-winning film, is one of his. Hell's Angels, as he was involved. That's what he did. He was a flying ace in World War I, and obviously this is not a flying movie by any stretch of the imagination. The ambulance is the only moving vehicle. Well, it's not actually. It's the only moving vehicle from whose point of view you see the action. But you're right. There's all sorts of other really great shots in a movie that doesn't really merit them just in terms of like what it's about or the kind of movie it was. It's much more visually interesting than you would expect.
Oh, goodness, no. This is a hacky potboiler all the way, but it is a hacky potboiler in the best possible sense. And what also shocked me about this movie, as much as I stan Stanwyck, as we have discussed many times on this podcast, she's not that great in it. There are flashes of that great Barbara Stanwyck toughness. There's a great scene where she goes like chin to chin with Clark Gable, and she looks like she's ready to deck him at any moment. But there's also times where she's like stiff and mannered. No. Joan Blondell is the scene stealer here. And that really surprised me, because just 2 years later, when we get to Babyface, which was one of the first movies we covered on this podcast, Stanwyck is acting at a level that blows nearly everyone else off the screen. Here, that's Joan Blondell.
100%. And when I saw the beginning of this movie, having seen as much Stanwyck as I had, I thought, well, she's making a sort of a cheap choice, because the part she comes in to this hospital, you know, as new blood, theoretically as an innocent person, or at least somebody who, you know, isn't part of this environment and doesn't know what awaits her. But as the movie goes on, you realize that she's just not that experienced an actress yet. She's been making movies for a couple of years, but sound movies are still really new. This is 1931 we're talking about. But you're absolutely right that by the time she gets up on her high horse, and I mean that in a good way, about let's not let these kids die and let's solve the problems that are going on in this house. By that point, she's sort of come into her own a little bit as Barbara Stanwyck that we know from Babyface and a lot of her other movies of the era. And I kind of feel like that indicates a breakthrough for her in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, Barbara Stanwyck, fresh-faced ingenue, does not work. She can't play it. You can watch her rebelling against it with all the funny little asides and facial expressions that she makes. Barbara Stanwyck, badass, tough as nails, you know, don't mess with her. That works, and that's what this movie gives you as it goes along. But I was also surprised at how great she is with the kids in this movie. We talked in The Public Enemy about how terrible the child actors are. The child actors here are actually kind of touching and even a little bit funny, mainly because they're given good things to say. And Stanwyck has a real rapport with them that I found honestly touching.
I tend to agree. I hadn't thought about that a lot. And think about the position those kids are in. Most of the time, those kids are lying flat on their back and they're playing sick. So clearly, they have to be, you know, smaller, quieter versions of what a kid normally would be. And they can't be stealing scenes in the same way that a kid might if they were running around or interacting with the adult actors. Basically, they're having to be sort of passive. And whether it's good direction or whether it's just Stanwyck's, ability to interact with those little kids, those are great scenes. And you have the sense immediately, and obviously you know by the time she meets those kids that she's going to be the heroine of the movie, but you have the sense immediately, oh, it's going to be okay because Barbara Stanwyck, our night nurse, is here.
Yeah, she's very good at projecting the sense that of an ironclad integrity, that no matter what, she's going to stick by her guns. And the more the movie gives her pressures that push against that, and that she has something to fight against, the better she gets.
Right. So when she starts out, she's come into this hospital to it's the depression. And I think that there are a lot of pre-code movies where they don't say, we're having a depression now. But there are movies where there are movies where the depression is self-evident. And that's the case here because she's out of a job. She needs work. And she quit high school to take care of her mother who has died. And now she's clearly too old to be indicating that she's a high school aged child. But she's supposed to be she's supposed to be in her early 20s, but she's not a high school graduate. She's not qualified to be a nurse by whatever that whatever that means, you don't have to have had a college degree by any means. But she comes in and through happenstance, and it's interesting because a man takes a liking to her and gets her in to take the nursing course. But it is, again, not a pre-code, hey, baby, let me help you be a nurse. It's a kindly doctor who ends up sort of being the hero of the piece later. Well, not the completely the hero, but who ends up being on the right side. And initially, he's just like, wow, I see something in this girl, whether it's that I'm attracted or whether I feel sorry for her or whatever, let's let her be a nurse. So she does.
Well, he's kind of attracted. He's not a lech or a creep, which I appreciate, because the movie can't let him be a lech or a creep. But the movie makes it very clear he is only giving her the shot because he thinks she's hot.
I think that more so, it's not even so much in their interaction. It's everybody else believes that that's the case. Certainly Joan Blondell does, because Joan Blondell becomes her wise counsel. And it is funny, if you say, all right, we're going to have a movie where Barbara Stanwyck is the naive innocent and Joan Blondell is going to show her the ropes, people in most cases would go, wait, that doesn't work. You've cast that wrong. Because either person could play that part, but I don't think either person can credibly call the sort of naive, be called the naive innocent of the movie. But that's kind of the job Stanwyck is given early on, and she becomes Joan Blondell's running buddy, and it's clear as the movie goes along that there's a little more to sort of naive innocence than Barbara Stanwyck. They stay out late and they get in trouble for it and all that kind of stuff. But it is an interesting position that I don't think Stanwyck could have played much longer in movies and be believable.
Yeah, and Blondell is just, I cannot emphasize how fantastic Blondell is. If you've seen Margot Robbie play Harley Quinn in Birds of Prey or The Suicide Squad, you know what you're in for here with Joan Blondell. Gum cracking, wise cracking. She is chewing gum in every scene. It's like the 1930s version of Brad Pitt eating something in every scene of Ocean's 11. But it's incredible. She's so funny and sharp. Her eyes just pop. They're so huge and expressive. And she is having fun to a degree that almost no one else in this movie is.
And she's not overplaying either. That's the thing. Like, she's owning the scenes that she's in. She's cracking the gum. She's given Barbara Stanwyck the sort of scoop. I love her whole discourse on, don't who not to get involved with. Don't get involved with interns. They don't have any money. Don't get involved with doctors. What you want is a rich patient, preferably somebody with appendicitis.
Yes, a nice appendicitis patient.
Because they all have money. Apparently poor people don't have appendicitis. But no, Blondell doesn't overplay. It's not, and she rarely does. Like, she's given more showy parts in other Warner Brothers movies later on. But she doesn't overplay, and especially in this, I think she doesn't have to. She's just like she's got it really sort of well managed, and it's delightful to watch.
There is some overplaying in this movie, and it's good and it's delightful and funny. But yeah, and thinking back on it, I can see the difference between Blondell and then between Charlotte Merriam.
Oh, God, yeah.
Who plays Mrs. Ritchie. She's overplaying, but she's doing a great job. The scene where she's like talking to her dog while like making
yes.
excuses. Yes. So folks, you need to understand that the morality of this film is subtle, complex. It works in shades of no. This is
all.
A film where Barbara Stanwyck is a virtuous, innocent nurse who goes to the house of a rich family that is just wall-to-wall drinking, boozing, and parties, and where the mom is too busy getting hammered 24/7 to ever even look at, think of, or interact with her two small children. It's not subtle.
No.
The look at these evil rich people drinking and boozing away. They care nothing for the lives of the little people is pretty clear-cut. But this movie has weird politics. That is existing alongside that moralistic, rich people drinking alcohol are sinful, exists alongside Barbara Stanwyck's boyfriend being a criminal.
He's a straight-up criminal. He's a sweet bootlegger. He doesn't actually kill people, but he knows a couple guys.
Yes. He robs a delicatessen with a gun. No one's in it, but he smashes the window. He delivers illegal alcohol to keep these booze parties running. But yeah, it works because Ben Lyon, even though he's not that great an actor, has this incredibly sweet face.
That's actually the only movie of his that I can think of where I find him the least bit memorable, because you're right, he's not that great an actor. I think the lines he's given and you're right about his face, but just sort of the combination of what little acting chops he has and that face and some of the lines he's given allow you to sort of buy the idea that, well, first of all, he doesn't come clean with Barbara Stanwyck about his criminal past. For, I mean, he's a bootlegger at the beginning, and we know that. And she pulls a bullet out of him, and later on, he sends her a bottle of booze. Which, I mean, come on, it's prohibition, but I don't think anybody's moralizing about the existence of booze. It's the criminal activity that goes on around it. And then later on, there is indication of his that he knows people who can kill people. And in the middle, he says to Barbara Stanwyck, "Oh, I gave it up. I gave up the criminal life." And he obviously hasn't, because he wants to be with her.
Yes, the movie makes it immediately clear to him, to Stanwyck, to the audience, he is 1,000,000% lying.
Yes.
But you like him because
he's adorable. He's just got,
yeah, he's got this cuddly, boyish charm. He's like a boy band, you know, or like a horse. He's attractive but non-threatening.
Right. He's interested in Stanwyck. He's going to be faithful to her, is the impression, because they're not really dating throughout the movie. He is attracted to her, and he leaves the hospital after she takes the bullet out of him. And then we see him somewhat later, and he's in a position to help her out. And he happens to be the booze deliverer for this household of debauchery where she's working. And so there's several times in the movie where they're like, OK, well, bye then. I'll catch you later. And they do happen to run into each other a few times, which furthers their relationship. But it's not till the very end of the movie that, I mean, you know he likes her. You know they like each other, but it's not till the very end of the movie that they get together. So there's not even really a moral issue about, well, I kind of lied to you, because she finds him out. Like, he says he quits, and she almost immediately finds out that that's not true. And, well, they part ways at the end of that scene. But the next time she sees him, he's in a position to help her, and she's like, oh, all right, you're cute.
Yeah, it's kind of fun and refreshing, because there's never like, oh, you're a bootlegger, how could you? Right. She's like, no, I know exactly what you are, but, you know, you're a sweet guy. And he turns out to be a genuinely stand-up guy. Like, when you tell him a child is in trouble, she needs help by any means necessary, he goes out and helps that child by any means necessary.
Which is a good thing, because then we don't have Clark Gable to kick around anymore eventually.
Oh.
So, yes, Clark Gable, this is a very early role for him, and he is the brutish chauffeur and a villain of the piece. And he is playing a wooden, brutish, snarling, terrible human being who punches. The people he punches are all women. He's a very scary individual. Speaking of the Public Enemy, James Cagney was supposed to play this part, but then when he became a big star in the Public Enemy, they were like, you know, there's this new guy named Gable. Why don't we give him a shot?
And Gable's great. I mean, he is fantastic. That voice, you don't think of Clark Gable as the bad guy, but you've noted before that Gable has like a nasty streak to him in a lot of his movies. And yeah, it works for him here. The voice that can be commanding or charming elsewhere is really disturbing and frightening. He's quick and mean and nasty in a way that you really rarely see from him. He also swans into the film wearing a black silk kimono.
Right.
And the first thing he does is punch two different women. And it's at least to me, I didn't think it was played as, you know, well, he's slapping the dame around because she got hysterical. No, it's played as, this is a bad thing done by a bad man. This is not the correct way to handle any of this.
Right. Yeah, there's no sympathy for what he's doing. And as you find out later on, sort of the devices that why he's doing what he's doing, why he's in this house, because he's a chauffeur. But as you say, he's in that kimono. So he's clearly having a relationship with somebody, probably the rich woman who's a dipsomaniac through the whole movie. And the sort of, I'll just to line out that story. So this woman, Mrs. Ritchie, her husband has died.
Mrs. Ritchie, I just got it.
Yeah,
oh,
I know.
Dear God, this
little,
is not a
that's
subtle
a little bit
movie.
On the nose, isn't it?
Well, I mean, when her character is named Laura Hart,
right?
And the bad guy is named Nick, which is, you know, a nickname for the devil. I love right. The introduction scene where, you know, who are you? And the camera like pans out on him in a big dramatic shot. He says, "I'm Nick, the chauffeur." It's
subtlety. It's so much subtlety in this
movie.
It's
hilarious because it's the words are so anticlimactic and the presentation is so dramatic. It's like if, you know, when John Wayne is introduced in Stagecoach, the camera would swoop over the landscape and he'd be like, "Hey, I'm Bob."
Well, and two, like, just to, I'll get back to the plot part in a minute, but two, his physicality is really different than later Gable, not only because he isn't a leading man in this movie, but he really is until he actually swings his arm out and punches somebody, he's just very stiff and straight and tall. And I think that also makes him menacing, not only when he's in the scenes with women, but in the few cases where they're men. They're not that many other men in this household. They're drunks that are sort of lazing around and stuff like that, but they're no match for him, obviously.
And that costume does half the work for him. I wasn't kidding when I said he's Darth Vader is a fascist chauffeur.
100%. Yeah, so we have the kimono, and then later on we see him in the chauffeur's uniform, which is sort of hilarious. But yeah, he is every bit threatening in every frame that he's in. So Mrs. Ritchie's husband has died. She's left alone with three children. Wait a minute, didn't we say two before? Oh no, one died in a terrible traffic accident. Who drives the car in this family? So it turns out that the plot is keep Mrs. Ritchie drunk and take away the kid's trust fund and allow the children to die so that he has complete control of Mrs. Ritchie and her money. So, yeah, it's just a sweet little film. Charming, delightful. Yep. Let's let children die of starvation.
We learn about the death of the third child from the two other children who have internalized this to a deeply traumatizing degree, where even Barbara Stanwyck is like, repress those memories, children. Repress them as hard as you can.
That's like the first interaction they have. Oh, hi, we're really hungry, and our third sister is dead. And
her face was all cut up, they say. It is a moment of quiet horror in an otherwise very entertaining and funny movie.
Yeah, it's dark. And the method they're using to kill these kids is essentially to starve them. There are periods, especially once the housekeeper becomes a little more alarmed, as she should have been previously, where I'm wondering, why couldn't Barbara Stanwyck just give the kids a sandwich?
That's what I'm wondering too.
And by the time later on, when it would be the right, when she would have more ability to do that, the kid is so ill that they probably couldn't take food. But I'm like, the first night she comes, I'd be like, I'll be back. I'm going to go down to the deli and get the kids a sandwich.
Yeah, they do mention that, like, the kids get so sick that they can't keep anything down or up. How do you keep something up?
I don't want to think about it, but yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, it is weird, but I think they don't want to... This movie is weirdly squeamish about violence. For all the times that it is, will happily show you two women stripping down to their underwear and then hopping in bed together in a scene that had to make an entire generation of young women sit up and go zing. Weirdly prudish about violence. The existence of a gun, no one has ever like draws a gun on someone else. The existence of a gun is used to smash a window, but that's it. When a guy has a chance to draw a gun on someone, he keeps it in his pocket and just knocks it against the door frame. You never actually see Gable throw a punch in this movie. The only punches that we see thrown are when Barbara Stanwyck awesomely decks a drunk guy.
Oh, it's so great.
Because
this house apparently is full-time Party Central. And so there's the dipsomaniac with her dog, who is the titular owner of the house. But then there are all these random party guests. And the way we meet Clark Gable is that a drunk has met Barbara Stanwyck, and he's decided he wants to have his way with her. And then Nick comes in and dispatches the drunk. And then basically he starts interacting with Barbara Stanwyck. And she's like, oh, so you want to do what he did? He's like, no, I just want you to leave those kids alone and stop, you know, basically stop giving me lip. And she will sock the drunk and Gable will sock her. There's a lot of real and implied punching going on, and of course he hits the housekeeper, who's this older woman who's kind of getting hysterical once she belatedly figures out that these kids are really in danger.
And there's some weird stuff in this movie if you just scratch just below the surface. I almost wondered if there was some anti-Semitism to this movie, because Dr. Ranger, I mean, Ranger is obviously, that's an Anglo-Saxon name, but he's cast and he is played as if he had certain stereotypical mannerisms about him that left a bad taste in my mouth. And then the fact that the bootlegger boyfriend robs a Jewish delicatessen, I wasn't sure what to make of that. I was like, this movie's politics are all over the map. You've got like the right wing, you know, booze is sinful and degrading, and you know, the culture of victimhood is tearing this nation apart, and we must have strong family values. But then on the other hand, you have these wonderful scenes of, you know, a whole multi-ethnic community of people in the hospital. There's a great scene of a mom from China like cussing out her kids in either Mandarin or Cantonese or something, to which her youngest boy just replies, "Aw, nuts." There's an extended scene involving breastfeeding where, like, she hands all these multi-ethnic, multiracial babies to their respective moms, and you hear very distinctly the sound of nursing as they tuck the babies under the sheets to their breasts. And I guess at this time formula wasn't widely available, so that was just how you fed babies. But today it plays as, like, nicely progressive. They're not ashamed to show breastfeeding.
My guess is that whether formula is available or not, it might also have been a financial thing. It might have been that wasn't something that those women could afford necessarily, because you get the impression that it's a ward and it's a pretty wide swath of socioeconomic class. But let me talk just Dr. Ranger. What I took from that, from the mannerisms thing, was that he's a dope fiend of some kind.
Yeah, he does kind of sniff a lot. And I'm like, are we supposed to think he's a coke fiend?
Right, because Dr. Ranger is the bad doctor. He is the one that is ostensibly taking care of these kids. And the mother, Mrs. Ritchie, is so brainwashed that she says things like, Dr. Ranger is a great doctor. And I'm like, who even did that? That doesn't seem like Nick's style. Nick's style would just be to hit everybody and scare them into doing whatever he wanted. But Dr. Ranger Barbara Stanwyck has a whole thing throughout this movie about medical ethics being crap. And medical ethics is defined in this movie as a doctor's relationship with his patient is sacrosanct. No other doctor or other medical professional can do anything without the permission of the doctor in charge. And Dr. Ranger, this guy who is only in a couple of scenes in the movie, maybe just one, is the guy who's running. He's part of this scam with Nick. And he may or may not be a dope fiend. I sort of like to believe he is because it makes him make more sense to me. And he's not there to give Barbara Stanwyck permission to do the things that would save the child's life. And the good doctor at the hospital, who she eventually goes to consult about this, is like, look, I can't get involved. It's not my patient. So Barbara Stanwyck is repeatedly saying, oh, medical ethics. And medical ethics as opposed to compassion, which is what she's all about. So medical ethics is sort of a shorthand for the rules of medicine, not for, you know, what we would think of as medical ethics, which is, wait, that Dr. Ranger guy, he should be thrown out on his ear because he's a bad doctor.
Yeah. For one, you would think that a doctor who repeatedly killed children in his care would not have a successful and thriving practice among the wealthy right. citizens of New York. But what do I know? Second, that's kind of like, for me, I read that as more of this movie's weirdly right-wing politics. You know, the regulators and the system are you know, bunk. What we need is a bold individual to take action based on their gut instincts. And three, you know, maybe it's a stretch, but it's pretty interesting if you stop and think, Nick the chauffeur, he's supposedly in a relationship with Mrs. Ritchie, but he never seems interested in or attracted to her. But he seems really close to this Dr. Ranger guy. They have secret clandestine phone calls together.
You know, I like that because the idea that he shows up in a kimono to me, I think, was meant to shorthand that he is sleeping with Mrs. Ritchie as part of his way of influencing her. But I much better like the idea that he's just really, really comfortable and she's in the bag most of the time. Anyway, she's so far gone that she doesn't really care what he does. She clearly is deferential to him, but that could just as easily be out of fear or out of some sort of, you know, additional substances. It could be more than alcohol that's pickling her brain.
Yeah, they keep her happy. They let her do what she wants and they reassure her that it's not her fault and she's not a bad person. And that, I think, is why she's so much under her sway, because deep down, I think the movie is trying to imply she knows she's rotten, but I guess she's so grief-stricken from the loss of her husband that she just can't cope. And so they say,
her first child, don't forget.
Oh, yes. And so they say, no, it's not your fault. Here, have all the booze you want. And she's like, okay, I can work with this.
That's kind of the way I take it, because she's not making a move to help her children, but she really is in a sort of a desperate stupor. Like when she speaks, she has this sort of pleading, confused, her hands are up in the air going, I don't know, I can't do anything about it. And Nick and Dr. Ranger, they know what to do, blah, blah, blah. And yeah, I think she's so far gone. And whether it's just the grief or the guilt or whether it's the substances that are making it 10 times worse. Yeah, and the movie never resolves that, right? So we get rid of our villain in the end, but we don't really know what happens to her, what happens to those kids, because she's just sort of a prop. She never really takes any sort of role either to make things better or to be sent off packing somewhere.
Yeah, and she does not have a single scene with the children. She never interacts with them, which is bizarre. But yeah, the movie's not interested in her reformation. They're interested in you cheering. She's meant to be like a straw person, basically. She's meant to be the stand-in for all the rich people who don't care about the little folks. You're meant to like see this movie and thrill that like a rich bad person is getting theirs. And when Stan like lays her out and drags her across the floor by the hair, you're meant to be like, yeah, Barbara, give it to her.
Right. And again, that's the sort of implied depression politics, because we start out from the premise everybody knows the depression is happening and it's deep and a lot of people don't have work or a lot of people are doing whatever they have to do. And I think that's part of the bootlegger thing. I think because Ben Lyon plays that bootlegger as an appealing character, and because it's prohibition, and because that's, you know, there is an element of prohibition that says oh, well, bootleggers are fine. They're just giving people what they want. As long as they're not killing me, you know, the perception, the gangsters are all killing each other. So what do I care if they sell a little booze here and there?
Yeah, when we talked about the Roaring Twenties, I called James Cagney the nicest gangster ever. But I think Ben Lyon here takes the cake, especially when we learn at the end. You don't find out his name until literally the last scene of the movie, when you find out that this bootlegger's name is Morty.
Morty.
I love it. Like I love it so much.
And Barbara Stanwyck is like, hey, what's your name? That whole last scene when they're driving off in the car and he's having her shift because his arm is so great. And they're just like, they're going to be so adorable together.
They are. And yet, speaking of awkward shifting, we don't just have Barbara Stanwyck shifting the car into reverse and repeatedly rear-ending the guy behind her. But also during that light, funny, wacky scene with its, you know, hilarious, ha-ha, women can't drive comedy, we have Morty casually mentioning, oh, that problem you had with Clark Gable, I solved it by having him murdered.
Right. And he doesn't even say that, but it's obviously what's happened. And then we see in a flashback to the beginning of the movie, we see an ambulance coming to the hospital with somebody dead who was in a chauffeur's uniform. So if it wasn't clear what happened to Clark Gable, they put the point right on it. And we never see any of that, as you say, violence off screen, but Clark got his from Morty's friends.
Yes, and having found this out, Barbara Stanwyck smiles and leans closer to Ben Lyons. Oh, you murdered a man for me. How sweet.
Aw, sweet. Well, let's not undersell the scantily clad women part, because the reason I started this conversation with saying that this is not a movie about illicit relationships and bosses screwing their secretaries or whatever is because those movies often have actual things happening in them that are pre-coded and they're shocking to the sensibilities of the early 30s. But a lot of times those movies don't actually have scantily clad women. Some do, some don't. This movie, however, dispenses with all of the weird illicit love affairs, but yet has women undress at the drop of a hat for any number of different audiences.
Yeah, if it were any more gratuitous, you'd almost expect there to be like Swedish organ music playing underneath. There's literally a point at the beginning where Barbara Stanwyck says, before shrugging and deciding to strip down to her underwear, well, I guess you there's nothing I've got that you haven't seen already, which a male intern later swans in and makes the exact same point. But yeah, it happens over and over and over again. I mean, it's sort of like we did that movie Hot Saturday, and there's that scene where the female lead like throws her teenage sister down on a bed and like yanks her clothes off because her teenage sister has been raiding her wardrobe. I thought you couldn't get more gratuitous than that. And then this movie showed up and said, hold my martini.
Yeah, and it doesn't really have any role in the movie. Like I said, the intern ogles her and says, you know, I've seen it all, but there's no consequences in terms of anybody's virtue being at risk or anybody who's going to later on be a problem for the women, you know, seeing that. It's just, it's comedy and it's, you know, something to make the movie look more interesting. And then the scene where Barbara and Joan's character, I can't even remember Joan's character's first name. They call her Maloney throughout. But Maloney and Laura Hart come back to the room where they live in the hospital late, and there's a curfew, and then they're still fully dressed and they get caught and they jump in bed together. And yes, that's That may have been a gratuitous scene, but it was delightful.
It is delightful. I mean, they are both very good looking. I just, yes. I apologize because I've made this joke before, but I feel like J.J. Abrams would watch this movie and go, maybe there are too many women in their underwear in this film. but yeah, it doesn't serve any purpose other than sheer eye candy for the men in the audience and I guess 10% of the women. But yeah, you said they were fully clothed. No. The first thing they do when they sneak into the hospital is immediately remove their dresses so that they are running around in their underwear. And then an entire extended comedy scene plays out that takes place with them entirely in their underwear. Jumping into bed, jumping out of bed, jumping into bed together and shivering and cuddling up with each other and spooning. Yeah.
I like the part where they're trying to figure out how to put their heads so that when the door inevitably opens and they get caught, it won't be apparent that they've been out. And Joan Blondell says something like, my makeup is on the back of my neck. They'll be able to see that.
Yes. And that the take she does where she's lying in bed with the covers up to her neck and she opens one eye to see if she's been busted and the look of resignation that comes on her face is terrific. Again, even though this movie's like, ladies, time to strip down your underwear. Where for no reason, Barbara Stanwyck and John Blundell are like, heck with it. We're still going to be awesome.
They're fine with it. And I what I think is great about Joan Blondell is I think she's happy to have a running buddy. Maybe Joan had a friend before and that she's gone. But I just feel like she meets Barbara Stanwyck's character and she's just like, you lady, you and I are going to be pals.
You know, it's weird because they almost set it up as like she doesn't like Barbara Stanwyck at first, but then she instantly changes her mind, likes her and becomes like her best friend and most supportive ally.
I think the point at which she doesn't like her is the point at which there's some suspicion that maybe Barbara Stanwyck got the job because the doctor, she's having an affair with the doctor, or the doctor went, ooh, nice legs, I'll give you a job as a nurse. And so Maloney is probably a little bit dubious. Who is this person? Is she qualified? Am I going to have to cover for her if she screws up? That sort of thing. And then pretty quickly, it's apparent that that's not what's going on. She's like, all right, you're good. Because they're both trainee nurses, I guess, although Joan Blondell's character has been there longer. I don't really understand because they talk about at the beginning, she's going to, not that this really even matters, but that she's going to get a job as a nurse. And then pretty quickly, it's apparent that they're going through some sort of training program. They graduate from the training program. And then in pretty short order, she ends up as a private nurse at this house of horrors.
And none of that matters. I mean, the whole first 20 minutes or so of the movie, they're very entertaining. They're snappy and visually dynamic. They move along at a nice clip. But they have no bearing on the plot whatsoever. I think they're just there to have more opportunities to see Barbara Stanwyck and Joan Blondell in their underwear.
I think so. And I think there was at this time, there were a number of movies that had hospital scenes. There's actually one called, I can't remember if it's called Newborn or what it is, but what it's called exactly. But you were saying about the women breastfeeding their infants, and it reminded me of this movie, which is just like all about what goes on in a hospital when babies are being born. There are other movies. There's a movie with Kay Francis where she's a doctor, and there are all sorts of other sort of hospital dramas. They're not quite soap operas, but they are sort of in that setting, and it was one setting that was, you know, around in the 30s. This is probably one of the better movies in that situation. But you're absolutely right. Nothing in the hospital matters. The only character in the hospital that's going to matter later on is the doctor that ends up saying, ethics, schmethics, you know, let's take care of these kids.
Yeah, but I am struck by how well Wellman uses sound in a couple of those early sequences in the hospital. The sequence with the crying babies, if you've ever had, you know, or taken care of small babies, the sound of those crying infants will like grab you at the base of your spine. But the sound of the crying infants plays over a montage of all the things nurses do to like care for newborn babies. And it's actually pretty interesting to follow like a baby. Obviously you don't see the baby being born, but like starting right after it's born, the baby's getting washed off and getting a bath and getting its feet printed in ink and all this stuff. And you follow, you know, they line up all the babies in their big cart and wheel the baby cart into the ward with all the moms. And all this time, the babies are crying, and that's playing over this whole montage. And then as Stanwyck hands the babies off to their mothers one by one, the crying is replaced by the sounds of highly enthusiastic breastfeeding, which, at least to my increasingly dim recollections, is pretty accurate. Until it's just dead silence and this very prominent sound of babies enjoying milk and a smile on Stanwyck's face. It's a clever, funny sequence. And if you have to kill time and fill time, that's a really interesting way to do it.
It also sets up later on that we're going to have kids involved in this movie, because up to then, you're like, well, this is going to be a drama about how is Barbara Stanwyck going to get through her life as a nurse? Is she ever going to win over the tough matron, or is she just going to do something else? But we've added kids early on so that the first shot you see of children is not those starving little babies talking about their dead sister.
And it's just neat to see that slice of life from 1931, to follow that process all the way through the hospital. And I imagine it was interesting for audiences, too. You talk about like there being a lot of hospital movies at this time. Wasn't this around the time when hospitals started to get large and modern and industrialized rather than being like the local family doctor? So there was probably an element of folks from small towns wanting to see how they did it in the big city, and folks from the big city wanting to show off how modern and industrialized they had become.
Yeah, that makes sense, actually. And a little later on with Dr. Kildare, you get that even more in the late 30s, and those are better, more polished movies. But a lot of the dramas of this era are also about interns who, interestingly enough, and this is not relevant in this movie, and I kind of thought it was, but in a lot of these early movies, and maybe it was in fact the case, interns rode along in ambulances to calls, and interns, like the nurses, lived in little rooms in the hospital and were under not quite as rigid discipline as the nurses are, but they basically are, you know, serfs working for a very tiny bit of money until they eventually get to be full-fledged doctors.
Yeah, that was weird. I did not understand how nurse training works. Like, you live at the hospital and you are a slave to their regulations. And then when you graduate, you don't keep working at the hospital. You immediately get hired out to be some doctor's vassal instead.
I didn't understand that either. And again, it doesn't matter. And I kind of thought it did, like when they switch, once she graduates, it's like, and she goes through various services. She's not a maternity nurse the whole time or a newborn's nurse the whole time. Which is how she meets her bootlegger earlier in the movie. She goes to various rotations. But then at some point after she's graduated, she and Joan Blondell's character, both Joan Blondell is on the day shift and Barbara Stanwyck is on the night shift. And it's unclear to me how that commerce worked, but again, doesn't really matter. Just go with it.
Yeah, they put in the hospital stuff. You could start the movie with Laura Hart arriving at the house to meet the children, but then you wouldn't have the movie would be less than an hour, and you would have two fewer scenes of women in their underwear. Although I think they do sneak one in, you know, while they're in the house.
It's interesting because you see the women in their underwear primarily in the hospital. In the house, there's all this debauchery going on. And the indication of that is, of course, the woman who's a dipsomaniac, the drunk guy wandering around, also sort of jazz age flapper kind of music. But it's a real sterile environment. Like, you don't end up seeing like a big party full of half naked people. There's a scene where I think there are a few people dancing around, but it's like you have this giant house. There's actually not a lot of people. There's not a lot of stuff going on. It's kind of a weird environment. And yeah, you would sort of expect that if the scantily clad women theme was going to continue, that there might be a lot of women and that maybe you'd have a scene of Nick ogling them. But Nick is a businessman fundamentally and a thug.
Yeah. Those monsters, they are drinking champagne and wearing tuxedos and dancing to jazz. Yeah. I think that's the thing you're supposed to hate about them. Not necessarily that they're drunk, but that they are drunk while being incredibly rich.
That's a fair point. That's a fair point. Well, Night Nurse, it is one of those movies that I think is unbelievable for a lot of modern audiences, or at least very unusual. So I would absolutely recommend it. And to all those friends of the incomparable who we said, you should watch this movie. You should watch this movie. It's a good movie. Well, good movie in that it's entertaining. I mean, filmmaking-wise. Yeah. You did want to talk about William Wellman's sound, though.
Let's that the last thing I wanted to mention is the surgery scene, which, again, completely pointless to the plot, has absolutely nothing to do, doesn't set up any aspect of Laura's character, nothing. It's just, hey, Laura, before you graduate, you have to make it through a surgery without fainting. But the way they set it up, you have this weird animalistic growl of the respirator that helps build tension through this scene as the nice doctor is operating on a patient who we are told has like
doesn't matter.
Yeah, doesn't matter. Nice doctor. Dr. Nice. who Nick, by the way, later punches full in the face and like throws into a wall. I'm not sure how he thought he was going to get away with like physically assaulting a respected member of the medical profession on staff at a major hospital, but maybe Nick just wasn't thinking that far ahead. But anyway, Dr. Nice is operating. You get this eerie growl from the respirator. And then when the growl stops, that's when you know, uh-oh, something is wrong. He uses that sound as a cue in a really interesting way. Wellman, between this and like some of the wild inventive shots in Public Enemy, including the one where he like digs a hole in the ground to show a car driving over the camera, I'm really impressed with Wellman and his visual style here. He turns a very badly written movie into a very entertaining one through all these performances. But it is true. You mentioned he was a flying ace. The only people flying in this movie are the drunk people in The House of Horrors.
Well, that's Night Nurse from 1931. Nathan, it was delightful as always to have you. I'm glad to introduce you to another wild and crazy Stanwyck pre-code movie. It's what I do.
Hey, any more? You got more of this stuff? I want the good stuff. The piddly penny ante stuff doesn't cut it anymore. I need the hard stuff, Shelley. You got to help me here. I'm jonesing.
Know there's a standard now. I got a couple more, and maybe with Stanwyck, and maybe we'll just find a Blondell feature. There's lots of opportunities. Well, next time we're going to do something very different, and I'm going to be honest with you, friends, I haven't picked it yet, so it could be almost anything. but if you come back to Lions, Towers, and Shields over at the Incomparable Network, theincomparable.com/LTS, or if you find us on Twitter at Lion Tower Shield, because S's are extra, you will know before anybody else what movies we're discussing. Thanks for being here. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another movie yet to be determined.